Hello everyone and welcome to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. I'm your host, Eddie Palmgren, and with me in the studio is my friend and colleague Niklas Savås. Today we are excited to speak to Asif Surya, an entrepreneur and investor in the US, focusing on a specific investing strategy that we haven't talked that much about in the podcast yet. So Niklas, which book will we discuss?
So the title for this conversation is Asif's book, The Event-Driven Edge in Investing, in which he explains six different event-driven strategies, for example, merger arbitrage and stock buybacks.
And what do you think about the book?
So I like how the author has structured the book between presenting the evidence for why the different strategies work and how investors can use them. And as with many things in investing, there is a lot of noise, and the author helps us to distill which events carry more weight in the six strategies. And we think this book is useful both for focused special situations investors, but also for long-term investors in general.
The Event-Driven Edge in Investing was published by Harriman House in 2024, and we are delighted to discuss it on the show today. Here comes our conversation with Asif Surya. Hello, Asif, and welcome to Investing by the Books podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on today. I'm very excited to be on.
It's great to have you. And where are we reaching you today?
I'm based in the San Francisco Bay Area, just a little bit south of the city of San Francisco.
Okay. And to begin, we are curious to hear about your background and when your passion for investing started.
Yeah, so my passion for investing started in 2001. So this was right after the dot-com bubble had burst and we were in a deep bear market. Now, probably not the best time to start investing, but it was a great learning experience because I thought, how could the market go any lower than it already had? And sure enough, it does always. So that is a great way to start learning. I started out as a value investor, and then over time, especially during the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, I started looking into event-driven situations, starting with merger arbitrage. On the professional side, I was a technologist. I worked in technology, including enterprise software, for almost 20 years. And my last job before I started focusing full-time on inside arbitrage was with a mental health care company in San Francisco.
And today we will speak about your book, The Event-Driven Edge in Investing. How did it come about?
Yeah, it was very serendipitous in some sense. I met a friend for lunch in 2023. He had recently retired after working at Google. And we were both discussing things that were on our bucket list. So one of the things on his bucket list was to go to the Berkshire Hathaway meeting. And I realized that that was on my list as well. And so I decided to join him for the Berkshire Hathaway meeting. And that got me thinking about what are the other things on my bucket list. And one of them was to write a book. I'd started writing a book almost 8 or 9 years ago, and I figured, you know, it was time to share, my investing experience, all the different case studies I'd encountered as an event-driven investor. So I reached out to Vitaly Katsinelson, and I reached out to Tobias Carlyle, and both of them did warm introductions with Harriman House, actually within 1 hour of each other. So I was able to get Harriman House on a Zoom call. And I told them, you know, it's been 25 years since Joel Greenblatt's book, You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, came out. And maybe it's time for a fresh look at event-driven strategies or special situations. And it looks like that resonated with them. And that's how the book came about.
And for those not familiar with event-driven investing or so-called special situations, how would you describe it?
Yeah, so there are certain kind of events that have a significant impact on the price of a company's stock. Quarterly earnings announcements are one of those things that everybody is familiar with. But there are other kind of corporate events, right? Like one company buying another company, a company deciding to break itself up into two or more parts, or even a company declaring bankruptcy. So each of these events, whether it's M&A, whether it's spin-offs, whether it's bankruptcies, they lead to opportunities for investors that they can benefit from. So investing based on these kinds of corporate events is called event-driven investing, or more popularly, special situations investing.
And I mean, as you said before, you tilted to become an event-driven investor yourself. What do you think the advantages are of that strategy?
Yeah, so if you look at most stock markets these days, they're very efficient. As soon as something happens, such as Trump winning the US elections, that information starts being accommodated, assimilated into the market very quickly, in the short term at least. Then there are sentiments of fear and greed that can move entire markets well outside where they should be trading. So sometimes they trade well above where the intrinsic value should be. Sometimes they trade well below. So that is one kind of macro level inefficiency that patient investors could benefit from, right? The old saying, buy when there's blood on the streets and be fearful when you're greedy. But that doesn't happen all the time. So event-driven investing in a similar way creates some inefficiencies or provides signals that may not be very well understood by the market right away. And that's what creates the opportunities for investors that understand these inefficiencies or these signals.
And what do you think are the biggest risk in this strategy?
Absolutely. So there is risk in every strategy, no matter how exciting it sounds. And there's a season for every strategy. So for example, merger arbitrage, which is a strategy where you buy a company after an acquisition is announced and wait for the deal to close. That used to work really well about 3 or 4 years ago when interest rates were near zero and the regulatory environment in the US was not as restrictive as it is now. This could obviously change now if there's a new Trump administration and they make some changes on the regulatory side of things. So merger arbitrage was great 3 or 4 years ago, not so good this year. But at the same time, if you look at something like spin-offs, they were not working so well about 3-4 years ago. They've started working much better now. So that's one of the risks where you have to understand why a certain strategy might be good for the current environment and why it might not always work. And that's the reason I track 6 different strategies so that there's constant idea generation, even if a strategy is not in season.
And when you say that a strategy is not in season, is that sort of... usually in investing, it takes a few years for you to understand that the strategy don't work, and then you have already made a lot of decisions. So, I mean, how do you sort of evolve continuously with that?
Well, I mean, you have to look at every different aspect of what's happening, right? So you got to look at what's happening with interest rates. So when interest rates are high, people have other alternatives. They can put their money in treasuries and earn a decent return. They can put their money in CDs and so on and so forth. So merger arbitrage becomes less attractive in that environment. It also becomes less attractive because you expect a greater rate of return from it. And usually you would get that only in the risky deals. So you have to look at what's happening in the macro environment. On the spin-off side, you also have to understand what's going on with general market valuations and so on and so forth. Are companies in trouble? Are they trying to spin off because they're trying to get rid of a bad division? Are they trying to spin off because things are going really well and they just want to allow the spin off to be its own independent company and grow? So you have to look at things in that context. There's also insider transactions where I've seen at times that during the COVID pandemic, the March 2020 big drop in the market, insiders stepped in and started buying way more than I'd ever seen a buy in the 10 years prior. So you can see these signals happen in some sense in real time, and you can adjust which strategies you want to focus on based on that.
And as you mentioned in your book, you describe 6 different event-driven strategies in detail, but we're curious how you selected these 6.
Yeah, so there are strategies like bankruptcies that are so complex that very few retail or even professional investors can participate in them. I selected 6 strategies for the book based on the ones that are readily accessible for all investors and not just institutional or professional investors. And I personally use most of these strategies for more than a decade, and I cover them on my website, Inside Arbitrage.
And if we go deeper in a few of the strategies, and starting with insider transactions, you mentioned that some transactions by insiders are more or less noise, while others can be seen as a strong catalyst. Could you provide an example from the book that shows the difference?
Yeah, so I mostly focus on insider buying and opportunistic insider buying. So by opportunistic buying, I mean an insider that is not buying based on a pre-established buying plan, that they've filed with the SEC, and someone who hasn't purchased stock frequently in the past. So I look for those kind of insiders to provide signals. One good example that I discussed as a case study in the book was insider buying in a company called Vertex Pharmaceuticals. This is a company that is quite large right now, and they had a very successful cystic fibrosis franchise. And there was an independent director who bought some stock in November 2020. And every weekend I write about insider purchases. And one of my subscribers read about this insider purchase. And he wrote to me saying, oh, this is Two Briefcase Bruce that's buying the stock. And if Two Briefcase Bruce is buying, I'm going to buy as well. And I wasn't sure what he was talking about. So I reached out to him and I said, hey, what do you mean this is Two Briefcase Bruce? Who's Two Briefcase Bruce? So he told me that in the early 1990s, Two Briefcase Bruce and him used to work in the same company together. Two Briefcase Bruce was actually Bruce Sachs. And he had an excellent work ethic where he would work throughout the week. And then on the weekend, when this was back at a time where you couldn't take your laptop home with you, he would fill two briefcases full of work-related documents and take them home and work on them over the weekend and come back on Monday. So he had a reputation for both being brilliant as well as being very hardworking. And so I took a closer look at this, and I realized that he'd been on the board of the directors of the company for almost 10 years, but he had never bought stock in the company before. So in November 2020, watching him buy stock, and then in August 2021, both him and the CEO were buying stock. I decided to make an exception. I normally don't invest in biotech companies because I don't understand them. But if Two Briefcase Bruce was buying, I thought it would make sense to buy as well. The financials of the company were actually pretty good. So they were making good money. This wasn't a preclinical biotech. This was a company that was actually making good money and was growing. So that made the decision a little bit easier. This is a historical example. This is something I wrote about in the book. And, you know, I wrote the book almost well over a year ago at this point. A more recent example is the hotel REIT, Pebble Brook Hotel Trust. So the CEO has a long history with the company, and he started buying in August, so just a couple of months ago. So this is a hotel REIT that had cut its dividend, as you would expect, during COVID. But when the business rebounded after the pandemic, instead of increasing the dividend again, they kept the dividend really small and invested the rest of the money in refurbishing their properties and fixing the properties. They also refocused from business to leisure travel. So given how well the company is doing, I think they're going to increase the dividend now that their capital expenditure cycle is winding down. So to make things interesting, this REIT also trades well below the value of all the hotels it holds. So here's something, it hasn't played out yet, but I think he's getting ready to increase the dividend now that the capital cycle is over, and you get a hotel property that's trading below its value on the books.
And just to ask, I mean, how big was that transaction? Because I think one of the points you make is that sort of big and infrequent transactions carry more signals than others.
Yeah, so in some sense, I do look for big transactions. In this case, I don't think it was a very large transaction, but I think he might make a few more before things turn around. So it is more the infrequency of the transaction where somebody hasn't bought for a really long time and then suddenly they buy. And, you hope that it actually makes sense, but the more likely scenario is it might not make sense based on all the data you have in front of you. And after a very long time following this, I'm beginning to realize that when it doesn't make sense is when it's actually more interesting.
Yeah, because it's interesting to know. I mean, you see the signal and you seem to be very good at picking those up. But then the question is, when should you actually make the decision to buy or sell something? And in the book, you write that, quote, insiders, like value investors, are often early to the party. So why do you believe this is the case?
So markets are often irrational, right? They never trade at where the intrinsic value of a company should be. And so insiders, like value investors, are viewing things rationally. So what they are seeing can often take weeks or months to play out. And the price action might even take even longer after the situation has played out. So I often find that, you know, value investors and insiders, they see value, but they're early because the market is going to continue to remain irrational for a little bit longer. So I've seen this pattern over and over again where whether it's Jay Hoag buying Zillow a few months before they announced a new CEO, or in this case, a CEO of Pebblebrook buying, often it can be several weeks or months in advance. Even in the case of Bruce Sachs, his first purchase was in November 2020, and the stock really actually took off after his second purchase in August 2021. So it can take some time for these situations to play out.
And do you usually wait, or how do you handle that situation?
That's a tough question. if the company makes a lot of sense to me right away, I do end up buying. There are times when I might actually have it on a watch list for a long time. So I maintain a very long watch list, some that are based on insider transactions, some that are based on meeting other investors at a Berkshire Hathaway meeting, and I got some ideas there. This month in November, in our November newsletter, I actually took an idea that I added on the watch list 3 years ago, because now I'm starting to see really good inflection in the stock price. So at the end of the day, it really is an idea generation strategy for me. And then the inflection, or when it becomes interesting, could be several weeks, months, or maybe even several years later.
And in the book, and also in this conversation, you mentioned that you do work every weekend. And something that you mentioned in the book is that you every weekend calculate a sell-buy ratio. So what is this?
Yeah, I probably work more on the weekends than I work during the week. I'm joking. But every weekend, we look at every single insider transaction, every purchase and every sale. We clean the data, and then we calculate the aggregate amount of insider buying and the aggregate amount of insider selling. And we divide the insider selling by the insider buying to create something called the sell-buy ratio. The reason we do this is we want to track this to see, are insiders selling significantly more stock than they used to? Or insiders buying all of a sudden a whole lot more stock than they used to? You have what is called earnings-related quiet periods. So, you know, a few weeks before earnings are released and a few weeks, even a few days after, you're not going to see a lot of insider transactions. So outside of that, once you adjust for that, if you suddenly see a big spike in insider buying or insider selling, that can be a macro signal. So for me, a macro signal of sorts was in March 2020, when insider buying exceeded insider selling for the first time in a decade. I'd never seen that before. Week after week, insider selling was almost 20 or 30 times the amount of insider buying. But in that one instance, for 2 weeks, insider buying exceeded insider selling. And you could also see this at the sector level. So in mid-2020, when WTI crude futures went negative, oil prices were negative, energy company insiders really stepped in and started buying hand over fist. I saw the same thing last year in early 2023 after Silicon Valley Bank failed. You could see that the bank insiders were coming out of the woodwork to buy. So I love looking at aggregate insider buying and selling data, both to see if it's giving me a macro signal on the whole market or if it's telling me something about a specific sector.
And throughout the book, you describe how investors can benefit from when some of these six strategies work in tandem, such as buybacks together with insider buying. Can you mention a situation for us where this situation made you interested?
Yeah, one of these interesting situations was the acquisition of this biotech company called Biohaven by Pfizer. So the acquisition price was around $148. Biohaven was trading around $141 when I wrote about it. So you got a chance to make about $7, $8 on the acquisition. And then right before the acquisition happened, I noticed that an insider, a director of the company, was buying stock. This is highly unusual. You don't see somebody buying stock, especially an insider, right before a deal is supposed to close. And the spread on the deal was something like 50 cents. And that made no sense. Why would a director of the company want to buy this stock for 50 cents a profit? And so I took a very close look at it, and they had a situation where Pfizer was going to spin off certain assets. So they were interested in the main migraine-related drugs that Biohaven made. And everything else was going to get spun out after the merger closed into another company, which they also decided to call Biohaven, just to confuse us investors. So I think his interest was in the new Biohaven because he knew that by buying stock before the merger closed, he would get the spin-off shares. And this was a strange situation where Pfizer actually put several hundred million dollars into the spin-off as well. So you had a spread you could capture on the merger, You got the spin-off and you noticed that there was insider buying going on. Sure enough, the spin-off went on to do very well. And we continue to see insider buying in the Biohaven for months and years after the spin-off as well.
And just to recap a bit on the strategy as a whole, I mean, in merger arbitrage situations, there is, of course, like a high probability that the merger closes, but there is a risk also that it's not, and then you usually have quite a big sell-off. So talking about risks in general, how do you think about portfolio construction in connection with an event-driven strategy?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. None of these strategies are risk-free, and especially merger arbitrage is also called risk arbitrage because you are taking on the risk that the deal might not close. And so with risk arbitrage, the way I used to position things, realizing that 95% of all mergers and acquisitions actually close, the way I used to position things was I would do my standard position size, like 5% of the portfolio. And if I felt like, you know, I had high confidence in the deal closing, then I might go even more. I used to do 10% back when regulatory environment wasn't so bad. Given how difficult it is these days to get a deal through regulators, I no longer do that. I'm back to my standard position size of 5%. In case of highly risky deals, I might even go down to a 2% position. So I might scale back the position size based on the amount of risk I perceive in the deal. In some situations, I might actually use options. I might use call options to limit my exposure and to juice the returns a little bit. Or I might even buy put options as protection. And some merger arbitrage focused investors will use a multi-leg option strategy to both control risk and to increase the potential returns.
And how do you handle the emotional aspects of things? I mean, usually when you have sort of a date that you're waiting for and you know that there is a risk that something could happen in a negative sense. I mean, have you learned to cope with that, or is that still an issue for you?
I think it's always going to be an issue for investors, right? I try to control for that quite a bit through the position sizing. So if I had one third of my portfolio in a risky position that wasn't working out, I think I'll have trouble sleeping at night. So by using position sizing, I think I control for that quite a bit. I'm usually not in just one merger arbitrage situation. I might be in multiple situations at the same time. And then I have a portfolio constructed from other ideas as well. So merger arbitrage plays a certain role in the portfolio. And again, within the specific ones I'm investing, I'm using position size so that it doesn't blow up the entire portfolio if a deal blows up. You can also focus on deals that, you know, don't have the widest spread and attract the largest attention. So everybody was interested in Elon Musk buying Twitter because there was a widespread on that. It worked out well. People were interested in Microsoft buying Activision Blizzard. That worked out well. But then JetBlue's acquisition of Spirit Airlines did not work out well. Tapestry's acquisition of Capri is not going so well right now. So you have to look at these situations and say, am I participating in the riskiest mergers with the biggest potential profit? Or am I participating in low-risk mergers where I can sleep at night if I use proper position sizing?
And just to get everything right here, so in terms of portfolio construction, you think differently in all these different six event-driven strategies.
Absolutely. So yeah. If it's an idea where I've done fundamental work based on a spin-off or an insider transaction, it's a 5% position. If it's a merger arbitrage situation, then it's the risk that determines if I'll make it a 10% position or maybe a 2% position.
Great. So let's move over to another type of strategy, which is spin-offs, which we have seen quite a lot actually in Sweden in the last years. Of course, a lot has been written about the outperformance of spin-offs, and you present the evidence for why these situations may work. And one reason is forced selling, as some institutions are not allowed to own stocks in a spin-off due to, for example, size constraints. And another more long-term benefit that you mention is that the company gets less bureaucracy. And starting with the first reason, can you please talk about when the aspect of size can have a particularly large impact?
Yeah, so let's say you own a large company like Jefferies, which was an investment bank, but it also, because of its merger with Leucadia, had a bunch of operating businesses. And so if you were a portfolio manager that was mostly focused on financial firms and you had Jefferies, And Jeffrey spun off an energy company like Vitesse Energy. So you not only have the size mismatch where you end up with a company that's only a few hundred million dollars in market cap, but also a company in the energy industry, which is cyclical and maybe it's something that you normally avoid. So you have a situation where there's forced selling by professional investors because of size mismatch, because it's an industry they don't follow, they don't understand, or they avoid. So that's one of the reasons you could end up with opportunities because of the forced selling.
And why do you think, because we have seen this many times, why don't the sort of the forced sellers, why don't they sell before? Because usually it's sort of mentioned that the spin-off is going to happen. So why don't they sell before the spin-off is actually done?
Actually, that's a really good question, because sometimes after the spin-off, the parent can be even more attractive.
Yeah.
Right? So maybe they're like Jefferies and they say investment banking is a wonderful business in certain market conditions with really good margins. Compared to a cyclical business like oil and gas. And so they might look at it and say, I'm actually glad they're getting rid of this division that was dragging down the parent company. And if anything, they might buy more after the spinoff. And I've personally done that, where I've looked at a company doing a spinoff, and I either buy before the spinoff because I like both the parent and the spinoff, post-spinoff, which is what is happening with Western Digital right now. Or I might buy after the spinoff and I say, they got rid of the bad company, if you will. They loaded it up with debt, and the parent is more attractive.
And I think an interesting point you bring up is the timing aspect here, that about when to buy a spin-off. And I mean, taking those two aspects I mentioned into account, forced selling should be completed quite quickly. So, I mean, how do you keep up to date with the status, and how long does it typically take?
So we keep a list of all spin-off situations, just like we keep a list of all M&A merger arbitrage situations in the U.S. But I personally don't look at, you know, what kind of trading volume has happened in the spin-off, post-spin-off. For me, spin-off investing is more opportunistic. So I usually look at them because something about the parent or the spin-off caught my attention, because a subscriber asked me about it. Somebody who told me about, you know, Two Briefcase Bruce might mention, hey, Asif, what do you think of Western Digital? Or there might be an event, like an insider transaction in the parent before the spinoff, that make me take a look. So that's how I do it. It's very opportunistic. But my friend Rich Howe, who focuses only on spinoffs, he very carefully looks at, you know, what kind of trading volume are you seeing post-spinoff? And is it going to be like a week, or is it going to be 3 months before most of the forced selling is done? So he does the qualitative work, and he does the more quantitative work of figuring out when all the trading has happened. That's not usually how I approach it.
Interesting. And the benefit of less bureaucracy for the company, I mean, it's quite appealing for the long-term trajectory of a business. Do you have an example for us where with this change was especially clear?
Oh, absolutely. There are so many examples. Going maybe almost two decades back, you had Chipotle, the Mexican restaurant chain that was spun out of McDonald's. It was able to supercharge its growth by opening a whole lot more locations. So that did very well. You had Ferrari that got spun out of Fiat Chrysler. So that helped Ferrari, you know, continue to perform very well on its own, not be under a large bureaucratic automobile company. We spoke about Vitesse Energy, which has done very well once it came out of an investment bank, Jefferies. So you have so many of these situations where you can just see that if the company that is being spun out is good, they're not loading it up with a lot of debt. Freeing them up out of the parent company really supercharges growth.
And we're not going to mention all strategies from your book in this episode. We encourage everyone to buy it and read it for themselves. But one that I would like to bring up is management changes, as you mentioned, as a strategy. And at Redeye, we also put a lot of effort and focus on evaluating the people of a business. We think this is very important. But why do you consider management changes an event-driven investing strategy?
Yeah, so I feel like the CEO of a firm, they define the direction of the firm, and more importantly, the capital allocation strategy. If you look at a CEO and you see that, you know, their pay structure is egregious, it's very high, and they're not aligned with shareholders, that can mean something very significantly negative for a portfolio company if you already own it. Or if you see that the CEO is thinking about all stakeholders, like employees and shareholders, and you know their pay structures align with the interests of shareholders, they can do very well for the company. You can also look at their past performance, like we did with Larry Culp, who came out of Danaher, and he did very well at GE. So you can look at the past performance at a different company and see if they really move the needle, if they stayed there for a long enough time to make a change happen. So I see management changes as a very critical thing that, strangely enough, not a lot of investors pay a lot of attention to. And so I consider that a very significant event, and I added it as an event-driven strategy in the book.
Something that is quite challenging, I think, as an investor is these kind of transition periods that can happen in companies when you had a long-standing CEO that is leaving, and then the company hasn't announced the new CEO. How do you deal with such situations?
Yeah, this is a difficult situation. I don't have a specific strategy for it. I would look at it and see if the underlying business is very strong and if there are any red flags caused by this departure. So is it a sudden departure where there wasn't enough transition time provided to the board? Or was this a long transition period where, you know, you have almost a year or longer to make sure that somebody else is coming in and is going to be successful as a CEO? So strength of business and the transition period are something that I'm interested in, that I look at. Otherwise, I'm not quite as concerned. It also kind of depends on a case-by-case basis. So if you look at somebody like Phil Knight, founder of Nike, Howard Schultz at Starbucks, Larry Culp right now at GE, or Bob Iger at Disney, if one of these were leaving, then I would be concerned and I might even consider selling. But if it is not one of these superstar CEOs and the business is strong, there's a long transition time, then I'm a little less concerned.
Good point, because I think quite many of the investors that we speak to and quite many of our listeners of this podcast are like long-term investors. They're looking for companies to hold for many years in cases. Do you think they can also benefit from taking part of these kind of strategies that you are outlining in the book?
Absolutely. Like I said, my primary goal with these strategies and even with the book is to help you find strategies that generate ideas at the end of the day. You have to do your own work on them. You have to understand the companies and then buy them and hopefully hold them for the long term. So when I bought Vertex Pharmaceuticals, it's been 3 years since I did that. I still have that stock with me. I hope to hold for another few years. So these are long-term ideas that these strategies end up generating for me. The other advantage of doing your own work and fully understanding these companies, or as much as you can understand given public information, is when something doesn't work out and the market drops, it gives you the conviction to hold on to the company, even when things don't appear to be going well with the overall market. So doing your own work and diligence actually gives you the confidence to hold on if something is not going right. And if you've done your work and something is not going right with the company, you will also understand that it's a company-specific issue and not a market-specific issue.
And I think it's interesting with these kind of combinations as well. I mean, we talked a little bit about it before, but is there any other combination of these kind of strategies that you outline in the book or other event-driven strategies that you would like to highlight that are you have found are more powerful?
No, the combinations are the ones that I find the most fascinating. They don't happen very often, but we ended up building some custom screens on Inside Arbitrage so that we know when they happen. So one of them is, we call it a spin-sider screen. It's spin-offs with insider buying. So we run that screen to take a look at, you know, which spin-offs are seeing insider buying and which ones the buying is happening in the parent versus the actual spin-off. We also have what is called a double-dipper custom screen. This is not a roller coaster you ride at a theme park. It is actually a custom screen that lets you look at companies with insider buying and the companies buying back its own stock. So I like stock buybacks as well. Not just stock buyback announcements, but a company actually buying back its own stock and you know reducing the shares outstanding over time.
So Asif, apart from having written this wonderful book, you're the founder of InsideArbitrage.com. Please tell us about your business.
Yeah, Inside Arbitrage is a website that I created. Initially, it was just for two strategies, merger arbitrage and insider transactions. And then over the last several years, about 7-8 years, I've grown it into 6 different strategies. So it's a website that combines both tools and analysis. For every strategy that we follow, we create a set of tools that our subscribers can use to look at the data or run their own custom screens like the Double Dipper or the SpinSider that I talked about to come up with their own ideas or conclusions. We also publish analysis related to the strategies. So for example, every Sunday, we write an article called Insider Weekends. Or on Monday, we write an article called Merger Arbitrage Mondays. We also publish a special situations newsletter once a month. And that has two spotlight ideas, usually from these events, six event-driven strategies that we discuss in detail. And then we choose to add it to a module portfolio or to a watch list. So the site is about, you know, combining both tools and analysis. You know, for the do-it-yourself investors, they can use the tools and find ideas themselves. For the ones that want us to do some of the analysis work, we do that as well.
And is it only the US you follow, or?
Yeah, I have my hands full with just the US at this point. We hope to expand to Canada someday, and then UK, and then maybe the rest of the world, but not in the near future.
Yeah,
or create a franchise.
Yes, indeed.
but is it only, I mean only, but is it mostly retail investors, or are there also like professional users?
There are actually quite a bit of professional users. Some of the largest merger arbitrage focus hedge funds use our data and our service. So I would say it's a very good mix of professional and retail investors. The professional investors like our premium plans that combine the tools and analysis. Retail investors might choose a plus plan where it's mostly about the analysis part of it. So we have a very large mix of professional investors in our subscriber base.
Okay. And how is your team? It sounds like it's a team.
Oh, yes, indeed. It's very much a team. I have different team members assigned to each of the strategies. My daughter has been working with me for the last 2 years, and she looks at insider transactions with me every night. So we meet every night and look at every SEC filing and come up with ideas. And on Saturday mornings, we talk about which idea was the most interesting that we'll write about. So I have an amazing team that helps me with all of this because there's so much data to keep track of and then analysis on top of that.
Wow, yeah, that was my next question. How do you keep track of everything?
So meet with my team every day. We publish something called, event-driven monitor every morning that has everything that happened on M&A, spin-offs, insider transactions, management changes. So we put that together every single day and we look at it. And, we discuss what's the most interesting thing that's going on in each strategy. And then, every weekend we try to look at what's interesting for insiders that we'll write about. Every month, we look and see if there are two spotlight ideas that are really interesting for us to do further analysis on. So it's collaborating with my team. I have a quarterly meeting with some hedge fund managers that I have. I go to different investor conferences. So, it's a lot of different sources with communicating with professional investors, exchanging emails with retail investors, talking to my team and looking at the data.
It's clear that you have a lot of passion for this day and night.
Absolutely. It's one of the best things I could be doing right now. I really enjoy it.
Great. And how has the performance been over the years that you have covered? And you mentioned a model portfolio and so on.
So model portfolio until about last month was at reaching its all-time high. It was up about 47-48% since inception, which might not seem like much, but considering merger arbitrage is similar to like an income type of strategy. And the fact that we survived the 2022 bear market without much damage, it has actually done quite well. I'm happy with it. I think some of these situations that I'm in, I'm going to take some time to play out. So I want to look at a longer time frame, a 5-year or a 7-year return, and I think eventually they'll do well. This year has been particularly difficult. The portfolio has taken a hit because of bees like Spirit Airlines getting blocked. Or Capri taking a hit because the judge ruled against them. So this year actually has been harder for us than prior years. So since some of these ideas are long-term, I'm very confident that over a long period of time, the portfolio is going to do well. This year, as I mentioned, has been difficult because of certain merger arbitrage situations not working out.
So, Asif, as this is a book podcast, we always like to wrap up with questions about reading and writing. So besides your book, do you have any other material about event-driven investing or special situations investing that you would recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, so Joel Greenblatt's book, You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, is an excellent introduction to event-driven strategies. That's how I got interested. In some sense, if you think about inside arbitrage, it's a living version of the book, You Can Be a Stock Market Genius. And that's what motivated me to write my book as well. So that's something I would recommend checking out if somebody has not read it yet. There is also Brian Stark's book, Special Situations Investing, that was published maybe 15 years before Joel Greenblatt wrote his book, You Can Be a Stock Market Genius. Brian Stark basically managed a multi-billion dollar event-driven fund, and he wrote the book in the 1980s. I was actually very fortunate to have him read an early version of event-driven investing, and he gave me some feedback on the book, so I was very fortunate to have that. His book is no longer in print, so I need to get hold of a copy of it, and I'm looking forward to reading it someday. So those will be the two I would recommend.
Perfect. We'll put those in the show notes. And now you have written your first book. Do you have ambitions to write another one?
I do. I have a couple of books that I'm thinking about. I don't know if it's going to happen. It takes a lot of work writing the book. And most books don't quite end up, succeeding. You have a few thousand, sales, if you will. And most people who've written a book in the past had already warned me that if you're doing it to make money, you're going to make less than minimum wage. You want to do it because you're passionate about it. And so once I get really passionate about maybe another book, I will do it.
Do you feel like you got better as an investor writing this book, that it helped you in some way?
Oh, absolutely. I find writing really distills my thinking, and it really helps me think through ideas. And I've been writing for about 19 years at this point on the public markets, if you will, or at Seeking Alpha on Inside Arbitrage, so on and so forth. So writing this book, was an extension of all of that. But it also made me go deeper into each strategy, because it wasn't about, everybody's going to take my word for, this works or doesn't work. I had to find academic studies that actually backed up the intuition that I had about some of this. So writing is an absolutely wonderful way of learning and to dive deep into a topic.
Asif Surya, thank you so much for coming on Investing by the Books podcast to talk about your book, The Event-Driven Edge in Investing, and your business. Do you have something more you want to add here before we finish up?
No, this has been wonderful. If you want to look at my work, you can find it on insidearbitrage.com. You can also find me on Twitter and LinkedIn as Asif Surya. It's just wonderful seeing the depth of questions that you guys had, and I really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Asif.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. Follow us on Twitter at @IB_Redeye and email us at ib.podcast@redeye.se. To improve, we'd love to hear your feedback, so please rate and review us. Notice that the content in this podcast is not and shall not be construed as investment advice. This information is meant to be informative and for general purposes only. For full disclaimer, visit redeye.se. I'm your host, Eddie Palmian, and until next time, I sincerely wish you the best of luck on your journey through life and investing.